Mr. Speaker, Mr. Vice President, distinguished members of the Congress.
In January 1967, Lyndon Johnson violated a long-standing State of the Union custom. He told the Congress and the country something most Americans didn't want to hear.
I wish I could report to you that the conflict is almost over. This I cannot do. We face more cost, more loss, and more agony. For the end is not yet.
It was a rare moment of public candor and clarity on the war that was ravaging his presidency and threatening an historic domestic agenda.
Our adversary still believes, I think, tonight, that he can go on fighting longer than we can, and longer than we and our allies will be prepared to stand up and resist.
Johnson was right about that. The North Vietnamese did believe they could outlast the mightiest military force on the planet. What the president could not imagine was that they would actually do so. I'm David Brown, and from Public Radio International, this is Episode 5 of LBJ's War, a six-part series on how an American president bound for greatness lost his way and came to grief in a ruinous faraway war.
Our men in that area, there are nearly 500,000 now, have borne well the burden and the heat of the day. Their efforts have deprived the communist enemy of the victory that he sought and that he expected a year ago.
After his brief moment of truth-telling on Vietnam, LBJ has quickly reverted to the president's traditional role as salesman-in-chief. Here, that means putting the best possible face on a war that is proving much harder to win than anyone had expected.
General Westmoreland reports that the enemy can no longer succeed on the battlefield. So I must say to you that our pressure must be sustained and will be sustained. And until such efforts succeed, we just must firmly pursue our present course. We will stand firm in Vietnam.
Johnson is still on pretty solid ground here. At the time of the speech, two-thirds of the country remains behind the war. But the protest movement is gaining traction. And in early April, an influential voice is raised for the first time in opposition to the war.
I come to this magnificent house of worship tonight because my conscience leaves me no other choice. A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam.
The voice, of course, is Martin Luther King's, and the house of worship, New York's majestic Riverside Church, jammed tonight with 3,000 anti-war faithful, come to welcome the iconic civil rights leader to their ranks.
The world now demands that we admit that we have been wrong from the beginning of our adventure in Vietnam. In order to atone for our sins, we should take the initiative in bringing a halt to this tragic war.
For those in attendance, Dr. King's decision to break his long public silence on Vietnam is cause for celebration. For Dr. King, the decision is fraught with political risk.
You rarely see times when he will just simply read a speech. And this was one of them. And I think it was because he knew what was at stake.
Stanford historian Claiborne Carson has devoted three decades to the study of Martin Luther King's life and times.
With the Vietnam speech, he wanted to be precise about what he would say because he knew that it was going to generate criticism.
Many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. Aren't you hurting the cause of your people?
In fact, Dr. King has had reason to hold his tongue. Whatever his private misgivings about the war, taking them public can only antagonize Lyndon Johnson, who is the architect of that war, but also the man who has done more for the cause of racial and economic justice than any president since Abraham Lincoln.
Dr. King was always very optimistic about President Johnson.
This is Andrew Young, a confidant and close aide to Dr. King, in a 1970 interview.
I think we thought that here was a guy that could get things done, who knew the legislative machinery of the government. Dr. King used to always say that if a Southerner ever really gets converted, then there's no better ally.
Recognizing what the new man in the White House could mean to the nation's poorest citizens, King was among the first to offer public support after the Dallas assassination put LBJ in the Oval Office. Johnson, for his part, was quick to acknowledge the gesture.
A good many people told me that they heard about your statement, I guess, on TV, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
This call takes place on November 25th, 1963, just 3 days after the assassination.
I've been locked up in this office and I haven't seen it, but I won't tell you how grateful I am and how worthy I'm going to try to be of all your hopes.
Well, thank you very much. I'm so happy to hear that. I think one of the great tributes that we can pay in memory of President Kennedy is to try to enact some of the great progressive policies that he sought to initiate.
Well, I'm going to support them all, and you can count on that. And I'll have to have y'all's help. I never needed more than I do now.
Well, you know you have it.
Thank you so much, Martin.
Through the heady early days of the new administration, King and Johnson did in fact forge an effective alliance around the president's hugely ambitious Great Society agenda. According to Andrew Young, it was an alliance based on mutual respect and common ground, not personal connection.
I don't think they had much of a relationship. Dr. King used to say that when you go to talk with President Kennedy, that he made you do all the talking. But when you went to talk with President Johnson, he did all the talking. Both Dr. King was a talker himself, so that no personal relationship ever developed.
On LBJ's side, striking the right political balance with Dr. King was a tricky proposition. By the summer of 64, Johnson was already in full campaign mode, preparing to face Barry Goldwater in November. While he needed King's behind-the-scenes help on the legislative agenda, too cozy an association in public could hurt him with the crucial white Southern vote.
Now, you say I've been in touch with Martin Luther King continuously.
No, that's the type of mistake I said.
This is White House Press Secretary George Reedy in July 64.
I haven't been in touch with him at all and don't want to be. You know his record.
I know.
It's the last thing. The president has been in continual touch with Dr. King.
That's a mistake in the transcript, which I've gotten corrected. I said from time to time he has seen Martin Luther King is what I said.
Well, why do you say that?
Well, you saw him at the ceremony.
Well, I say, why do you say it?
Because I was asked because they'd seen you there.
Well, all right, then don't just say it. You've seen him. Just keep that out, though. I'm sorry he was there. It's very unfortunate he's there, and don't you get hung in on it. That's the last thing I want. They're making an issue on you, and you'll hear from King before this campaign's over with.
In the event, LBJ need not have worried. In November, he would carry the black vote by huge margins and win the white vote as well, beating Goldwater by 23 points. When he makes his post-election thank-you calls, Dr. King is among the first to hear from him.
Hello?
Doctor?
Yes, Mr. President.
Well, I just wanted to tell you that how mighty proud I was of a lot of folks last Tuesday and what a good job I thought they'd done and how they justified our faith and how many more now we've got to help get out of their bondage.
The conversation is formal and ceremonial, but you can hear the real hopes and expectations on both sides.
We are certainly all very happy about the outcome. It was just such a great victory, and I certainly appreciate your calling. We have some bright days ahead, I think.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you so much. I just want to give you a ring.
2 months later, in January 65, the unlikely allies are on the phone again. Fresh off his huge election win, LBJ is on fire, running the table on the legislative agenda that will gain him a place in the history books. The landmark Civil Rights Act of 64 is law and the Voting Rights Act in the pipeline. But the battle is all uphill when a batch of Great Society measures encounters resistance in the Senate. Johnson again calls on King to mobilize the black community in support.
You have no idea, it's shocking to you, the proportion of assistance that comes to your people in these bills. You can figure out, though, what $8 billion in education, what $1 billion in health, and what $1.5 billion in poverty do if it goes to people who earn less than $2,000 a year. Now, do you know who earns less than $2,000, don't you? That's what we got to do now, and you get in here and help us.
At the height of his powers, Lyndon Johnson is a nearly irresistible force. In this instance, though, no arm twisting is necessary. For the first time, Dr. King is dealing with a president of the United States who appears to want what he wants. Again, historian Claiborne Carson.
Certainly after the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, King took him at his word that Johnson was going to go much farther than any other president, actually before or since, to try to implement programs that he thought were essential as part of his ministry from the very beginning of his religious life. All of these things that King would have wanted a president to do, Johnson is saying, I want to do that. But there's this pesky little thing going on in Vietnam.
In the spring of 65, the first cracks begin to appear in the Johnson-King alliance, forged so auspiciously just 18 months before.
You know, the whole idea of paying for guns and butter at the same time, that becomes Johnson's dilemma. How is he going to afford the war abroad and the war against poverty at home at the same time?
As LBJ ratchets up the war, committing more troops, escalating the bombing of the North, the elephant in the room becomes too large to ignore.
Well, we began to see very early that Vietnam was what it's now come to be.
Andrew Young.
That we began to see that the crisis in the cities was demanding the funds that were now being diverted to Vietnam, and that domestic crisis was more dangerous and therefore more important to the country.
In late July, Dr. King lets slip to a gathering of supporters that he's, quote, not going to sit by and see the war escalated without saying anything about it. 2 days later, the comment shows up in the New York Times. The story's buried deep in the Saturday edition, but apparently not deep enough. When Dr. King calls the White House a few days later, the red carpet has gone missing.
Hello?
Yes?
Yes, President Johnson?
Yes.
This is Martin King.
Yes.
How do you do, sir?
Fine.
Glad to hear your voice.
Thank you.
I was calling because...
This is the first time King has experienced the president's displeasure, but the chill is quickly dispelled. King is calling with news that's troubling to both of them. The Voting Rights Act has run into resistance from the powerful Southern bloc in the Senate, and Johnson is back in his field marshal role.
Now, Smith comes out and says, my bill has had a lot of venom in it. I have a great hatred for the South, and I'm like a rattlesnake. I'm trying to punish you and all that kind of stuff.
For the moment, at least, the need for joint action pushes their simmering differences on the war off the front burner. For the next 30 minutes, Dr. King will get a close-up look at the president's extraordinary mastery of the legislative process at its most granular level.
But the Republicans are going to hold pretty well. They're not going to quit. They will not let a Negro vote for them. They just, every time they get a chance to help out a little, they'll blow it.
There are eye-glazing detours along the way to explain, for example, how a rent subsidy bill could help the poor.
Now, we'll say a man makes $200 a month in New York City working in a baker shop. He pays $50 a month rent, and his rent costs him maybe $67. Well,
By the 16-minute mark, Dr. King, no slouch of a talker in his own right, has largely fallen silent.
They're playing us, and we're not parliamentary smart enough. And they're getting tired of the heat from me. So I'm just fighting the battle the best I can. I think I'll win it. But it's going to be close, and it's going to be dangerous.
Here at last, King spies an opening and bravely takes his shot at damage control on his recent remark about the war. The comment was taken out of context, he tells the president, and not meant as a criticism. For Johnson, though, mention of the Times article is also an opening. In this case, a chance to explain himself and the terrible choices he's facing to one of the war's most influential critics.
You're very helpful, and I appreciate it. I did see it. I was distressed. I do want to talk to you. I've lost about 264 lives up to now, and I could lose 265,000 mighty easy, and I'm trying to keep those zeros down, and at the same time, I don't want to pull down the flag and come home running with my tail between my legs, particularly if it's going to create more problems than I got out there. I'm not all wise. I pray every night to get direction and judgment and leadership that permit me to do what's right. But
for the moment, the Vietnam rift is papered over. When the two men speak again a month later, the agenda is domestic, the mood once again cordial.
Hello?
Yes, Dr. King.
Yes, Mr. President. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good, and I thought you made a mighty good statement last night.
Yes, well, we had been a difficult situation here.
The difficult situation is what would later come to be known as the Watts riots, which only days earlier had devastated an impoverished black community in Los Angeles. Together, King and Johnson are working hard to restore order, and beyond that, to address the underlying conditions of urban poverty and despair.
I said what we've got to do is find a cure and go and correct these conditions, where the housing and the ghettos and the schools and the hunger and the unemployment and so forth.
Yeah.
And they're all God's children, and we better get at it.
In this conversation, King and Johnson are in lockstep, both men publicly condemning the violence while acknowledging its root causes. The one time the war is mentioned, Johnson is diplomatic and King conciliatory.
I'm having hell up here with this Congress. They all got the impression, too, that you against me in Vietnam. You don't leave that impression. I want peace as much as you do, and more so, because I'm a fellow that had to wake up this morning with 50 Marines killed. But these folks will not come to the conference table. And I'm...
That is, it's just unreasonable to talk about the United States having a unilateral withdrawal. And you have called 14 or 15 times unconditional help, and it's Hanoi.
That's right. That's the perfect position. That's just exactly the position. We just got to get them to the table, because there's no use of shooting when you can talk. Let's don't let this country get divided. If you got any suggestions or recommendation, why, I'm just as close as a telephone. If you got enough money to pay it, if you have them, why, call collect.
All right.
Goodbye. Let's not let the country get divided, the president tells Dr. King. But in August of 1965, it's already too late.
From 65 through 66, there was a long struggle.
This again is King aide Andrew Young on the grassroots anti-war efforts already begun by King's own organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Council.
The Democratic Party even started organizing meetings against us in the black community. They had a conference of preachers in Detroit. They pulled together all of our Negro newspaper editors to support the administration's stand. And we had to do then something to counteract that. So the Johnson administration was pulling the preachers together one week, and we pulled them together a month later and would explain our side. Because when Dr. King was convinced about something, it was kind of hard not to go along.
And so, by degrees, the war frays the King-Johnson link until it is broken, finally beyond repair.
No, by that time, I think we had lost faith in President Johnson altogether.
Altogether?
Yeah, altogether.
Did you come to question his sincerity about equal rights?
No, I didn't. I felt he was sincere, but I felt he just gotten himself trapped and was basically blind to what was going on around him.
Nearly 50 years on, Andrew Young's terse summation of what happened to LBJ in Vietnam still holds up pretty well. He got himself trapped, Young says, and so he did, between those who wanted to end the war and those who sought to prosecute it more aggressively. Between one fear of igniting a larger conflict and another of being the first president to lose a war, and between guns and butter. I was determined to be a leader of war and a leader of peace, LBJ told an interviewer not long before he died, and I believed America had the resources to provide for both. In this belief, Johnson proved mistaken, a miscalculation that would cost him and the country dearly. Dr. King, by contrast, who had never set foot in Vietnam and had no foreign policy experience or standing, saw what Johnson did not. The connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle for justice back home.
A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. And then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched this program broken and eviscerated, as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
As Dr. King had anticipated, his denunciation of the war did not play well in the heartland. Many who have listened to him with respect will never again accord him the same confidence, the Washington Post predicted. a view echoed in newspapers all across the country. Also, as expected, King's fierce broadside proved the last straw with Lyndon Johnson. As far as is known, the two men never spoke again. Only after Dr. King's death, a year to the day after the Riverside speech, would the nation begin to catch up with the view that conscience had finally compelled him to express that night in the Riverside Church. What happened when the nation did catch up with that view is the story we'll tell in the next and final episode of LBJ's War. I'm David Brown. This episode was written by Steve Atlas, the executive producer. The series producer is Josh Swartz, associate producer Sansan Tam, creative consultant Paul Taylor, researchers Jason Higgins, Tom Reinstein, and Robert Thompson. Original music by Ellery Kramer. For more info, visit lbjswar.org or find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please leave us a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. It helps others find the series. Special thanks to the LBJ Presidential Library in Austin, Texas. Major funding for this project has been provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor.